Welcome back to Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. I'm Stephen Downs. We're in Module 8, Ethical Practices in Learning Analytics. And this is Part 4 of the videos in this module on ethical practices. These ethical practices constitute one part of the four-part staircase that embodies all of Module 8. The four parts of the staircase: regulations, practices, culture, and then what I call an ethics of harmony. And it's interesting as we descend that staircase, how at the top of the staircase, we're in a more institutionalized, more formal, more legalistic kind of environment, and one which is based on reducing risks and is almost based on an ethos of fear. And as we descend the staircase, we get less formal, less institutional, more personal, more individualized, and it becomes more about the good that can be done rather than avoiding risk, and it becomes an environment of joy rather than of fear. And I chose the staircase because I think going down the staircase really is the more natural direction, the direction that we want to flow in. But as I say, you know, we're constantly pulled back up the staircase, back into the grip of the formalist institutional environment. Part four is going to look at IT governance frameworks. And is that a little too big there? Yeah, it is, isn't it? Let's just close that up a bit there and make that there. That's more the right size it should be. And let me close that black gap. We'll just attend to these little details of presentation, although not the world's most professionally done video, if I do say so myself. But considering I've done, 60 or 70 hours of video for this course, and I'm all by myself, making professional videos on top of everything might be just a bit too much. Anyhow, on to IT governance frameworks. And again, this is an area that in most of the discussions of ethics and learning analytics that I've read, we see nothing about. It's like it doesn't exist. And that's too bad, because there's a lot to be learned from these IT governance frameworks. I'm only going to slightly dip my toe in the water with this video. Again, it's one of these things that could be an entire course. And even if, you know, the role of ethics in these frameworks is just a small part of the overall framework, it's one of these small parts that could become implicated in every aspect of the framework. And it's the sort of thing where we want to say, yeah, I know I'm working in an IT governance framework and I'm on security or quality or whatever, but I should be thinking about ethics too. And where does that fit in? I mean, it's not just fitting in into a little role somewhere down in a corner, right beside, usability or accessibility. It should be something that permeates the entire framework. But I proceed myself perhaps a bit too quickly here. I'm just quoting from this core document that says, basically, many respected IT organizations and standard-setting bodies have established frameworks to identify the, quote, risks and mitigation strategies with the evolving cloud paradigm. And that's where you'll find most of these frameworks. Not talking about ethics or anything like that, but talking about new paradigms in computing. And we'll get an IT governance framework for cloud environments, which is what the core document talks about. or for risk management generally, or hosted IT facilities, or maybe new technologies like supporting blockchain, or supporting VR, or supporting conference systems, or student information systems, etc. The framework landscape is covered with a number of standards and specifications. And like I say, this is something that has been well discussed over the years. And, you know, the field of software generally has evolved from this creative, perhaps mathematically based, but certainly artistic kind of activity to a type of engineering. And it's known literally as software engineering. And there are very good reasons for that. And in the area of software engineering, we have learning software, which leads us to the badly named discipline of learning engineering. And the idea is to take approaches like these frameworks, these governance frameworks, and apply them to the development of learning technology and learning software. Like I say, there's a lot of good that can be said about that, but there are certainly some weaknesses to this approach, and we will discuss them in this video. But again, fair warning, we're only touching the surface of this and not getting into the sort of depth that it really deserves. So let's begin with one of these frameworks. And, you know, I'm working from this overall diagram here. And I'll be looking in particular at COBIT and ITIL. You can see that they play different roles. They have different scope of coverage. And, you know, you might say that COBIT is focused on the what and the ITIL is focused on the how. But the what isn't necessarily going to be, you know, what ethical standards or anything like that. It's actually quite different. So the what can be summarized as control objectives for information and related technology, COBIT. And it's an IT governance framework that helps, and I'm quoting here, that helps organizations address the areas of regulatory compliance, risk management, and aligning IT strategy with organizational goals. So risk management we've been talking about so far, same with regulations. And then it's that other thing, aligning IT strategy with organizational goals, that's where the ethics is going to come in. So it's a four-step process. Well, it can be described as a four-step process. First of all, understanding the enterprise. Second, determining the scope of the governance system. Third, refining that scope. And then finally, concluding the scope. And what we're doing here, what this is it isn't a blueprint for a governance system. It's a framework for creating a governance system. So it's sort of like taking our whole thing that we were doing and backing it up a step. And so that's why, you know, we're looking at understanding enterprise strategy goals, the risk profile, etc., and then considering the strategy. Considering IT related issues, compliance requirements, implementation methods, etc. And then finally, concluding the governance systems. So that's what we need, right? At least according to this approach, right? What we need are those things in order to create a governance framework for IT. So how is this governance framework going to work? That's what takes us into the realm of ITL. It stands for IT Infrastructure Library. And again, I'm quoting, it provides a set of best practices that have become the most widely accepted approach to IT service management in the world. I have no reason to believe that's not true. And certainly every experience that I've had with IT infrastructure and IT service strategies, there's a model pretty similar to this, which describes it. Interesting to note, and I don't know if it really comes through in the diagram. Remember before I was talking about the one-dimensional and the two-dimensional approaches. This is a multi-dimensional approach. These aren't just hexagons here. These are actually boxes. Each one of these boxes is going to contain various axes of factors and considerations. And it all revolves around the core central value that you're trying to produce. I would argue that that value should include the ethical value, but you know, in a typical enterprise environment, it's going to include other things as well. That defines the products and services, and then around the products and services, we have organizations and people, partners and suppliers, information and technology, value streams and processes. The data management framework that I talked about is a subset of all of this, right? It's going to contain elements of all four of these things plus the center, but it's going to be focused specifically on data. So it would be just one row of each of these boxes. So again, quoting, ITIL advocates that IT services must be aligned to the needs of the business and underpin the core business processes. It provides guidance to organizations on how to use IT as a tool to facilitate business change, transformation, and growth. And it's interesting to see it phrased that way, because when I first got involved in the development of educational technology and learning management technology in particular, one of the truisms was that when you introduce one of these systems to a learning environment, like college, university, or what, you're not simply layering the technology on top of whatever it was that you were doing before, but you actually change what you were doing before in response to bringing the technology in. For example, at Assiniboine Community College, we implemented a student information system. And one of the things that was discovered, I believe it was Colleague, but I know we evaluated both Colleague and Banner at the time. One of the realizations was that the information system required a lot more data and a lot more precise data than we were collecting at the time. So it was impossible to do a simple transfer from the existing system into the new system, because the categories that the new system required simply didn't exist in the previous data. So we had to redefine what all of our business processes were before we could even think about using the new data. And we see a similar effect with learning management systems, where a course as taught by a professor in an in-person class might not be nearly as structured, and definitely not nearly as pre-planned as you need for a course in an online learning environment. In fact, one of the things that I've done with my courses is I've continued to do my courses much the way I did them in person, which was, I had all my readings and my background and all of that and my notes, etc. But I would basically make up the course as I went along. And there were really good reasons to do that. It's a much more engaging, responsive approach to offering a course. And it worked really well for me. A lot harder to do online, and in fact there's a lot of pressure to adapt the way you create and organize your course before you offer it online. So that sort of thing happens here as well in something like an ITIL, IT management framework, where you need to do a lot more thinking about the various factors involved and the various components of your overall IT system in order to put it into place. You know, surrounding this model are things like political factors, environmental factors, legal factors, tech factors, social factors, and economical factors. And perhaps around all of those, because all of that is society, right? All of that is culture. So all of that is also going to include ethics. And that's going to need to come in from outside. That's an important realization, I think, that we need to have. The system is going to demand that we define ethics perhaps more precisely than we used to. Doesn't mean that these didn't exist necessarily, but the way they existed in no way resembled what they need to look like in order to be used by an IT management framework like this. We see similar approaches to IT governance in higher education. Now, this is a completely different way of representing it visually, but nonetheless, you still have your multi-dimensional element to it. In this case, the multi-dimensions are structures, processes, and relational mechanisms, which is really kind of interesting, right? So like data, function, and connection, perhaps, is a way you could put it. So the structures are going to be your organization structure, your roles and responsibilities, project management, and all the rest. Your processes, the things that you're doing with your IT, student information system, frameworks and standards, dashboard, portfolio management, etc. And then the relational mechanisms are where these things connect with the rest of the world. So you have knowledge management, knowledge sharing among universities, training and education. Interesting that that finally comes up. Corporate communication and the rest. So all of these are aspects of IT governance for higher education. Somewhere in there is ethics, but again, if ethics is just one of these little boxes, is basically going to be swamped by everything else. So you need to think of, you know, surrounding this as the learning or corporate culture of the higher educational institution, which includes, among other elements, ethics. In any case, the MDPI document here argues the best configuration is one where both worlds have a federal structure, where the infrastructure, strategy, roles, and procedures are centralized to avoid wasting resources, and the execution and operations are decentralized. Now, that takes us back to the governance models that we talked about at the beginning of the previous video. And so this approach is arguing for something like, well, a federal approach. But by federal approach, it's, you know, a little bit of monarchy and a little bit of fiefdom. Is what we have. And again, the objectives here, the core objectives, notice, avoid wasting resources. And that is the argument, and always has been the argument, for centralization. Empirically, it's not clear to me that centralization avoids wasting resources. There are many cases, for example, where governments have taken a number of individual communities and amalgamated them into one big community. And it's not clear that this ends up saving anyone any money at all. And certainly has an impact on the quality and style of governance of that community. Related to this is an effort specifically on ethics by the IEEE. This has been on for 5 years or so now, maybe longer. The IEEE P7000 series of standards or specifications, they're calling them standards, is based basically on the ethics of IT management. So there were 15 of these. Two of these have been discontinued. The one on personal AI agents and another on facial recognition. I actually sat on personal AI agents for a short time, and then priorities shifted at NRC and I wasn't sitting on it, but I followed their procedures throughout, and it was disbanded just a few months ago, actually. Others of them are still in progress, And a few of them have delivered standards. In fact, four of them have: ethical system design, employer data, ontology for robotics, etc., and the impact on human well-being, the mechanisms for considering impacts on human well-being. And the rest are all still in progress. The problem with the IEEE standards is once they finalize the standard, it, for most of us, just disappears and you have to buy it. So it's very much geared toward companies and enterprises that have the money to buy IEEE standards. I do not. And therefore, I haven't actually seen the contents of those four systems. And, IEEE is beginning, that they've released now one standard openly that I know of. And that was their first, and that happened just a few months ago. And they may release more openly in the future. But that's been, to my mind, the big problem with IEEE standards. How can it be a standard if you have to pay for it? In any case, the IEEE is just one organization. ISO is another one well worth keeping in mind, addressing standards for all of these. And what's important here is that the process that they're undertaking for ethical standards in AI and analytics is similar to the process that they've undertaken to create other standards for IT governance generally. And it's not a bad process, and it is comprehensive, and it has demonstrably led to systems that are safer and more secure. Certainly, you wouldn't want to fly in an aircraft that did not follow the standardization practices, or eat food or take medicine, etc. So there's definitely a positive role that's being played by these standardization processes. On the other hand, and this is what I encountered when I was sitting on 7006, is that it's engineers doing ethics. And from my experience was that the engineers doing ethics didn't have the background in the various ethical theories, and certainly did not have the background in things like the ethics of care that we've discussed. And they approached ethics as though it were an engineering problem, and that you could, if you engineered the process properly, you'd get good ethics out the other end. It's not clear to me that that's the case. In all of these systems, not just ethical systems, but for safety, security, etc., what comes out the other end depends very much on what goes in. For example, with safety and security, the presumption going in is that people want safe and secure software, and that everybody in the enterprise is involved in the process of creating safe and secure software. Although there are mechanisms and processes you can use to augment or even increase the awareness of safety and security in software design or in enterprises generally. It's not clear that the same exists for ethics. I think we've shown pretty much definitively in this course that there isn't the same agreement that things should be ethical the way there is agreement that things should be safe. What counts as ethical varies from place to place to place. The idea even of talking of autonomous systems or autonomous agents, as we were in 7006, and considering that these agents or these systems might, because they are autonomous, be self-responsible for their own actions and therefore leave their owners or their controllers not responsible for the actions that these systems undertook. And that was very troubling to me. But sure, it's a nice solution to the engineering problem, and that's how it was presented. So I'm kind of glad 7006 didn't produce anything, although that wasn't the result of my intervention by any means. In all cases, with all of these frameworks, it's always going to be a bit of a measurement problem and a bit of a chicken and egg problem. And this diagram really illustrates that quite well. In fact, well enough, I'm going to pull it up on the screen here so that we can all have a look at it. So let's open it up with Firefox. And what page was that on? That was on page 14. So let's go have a look at page 14 here. Oh, what else? Oh, yeah, right. Great. Let's not get diverted. That's just the review process that they followed, and here's all the different studies that they looked at. There's a really typical sort of research process. Here's the diagram that they came up with, the ITSM benefits conceptual model. So let's make that bigger so that everybody can see it. So full right screen. Right. Bigger. Is there a way to see this whole thing here? Seems to me there should be. Oh, let's do it this way. We'll open it with PDF Exchange. There we go. And we'll pull it down. Here we are. And I believe I have a way of. There. Oh, jeez. There we go. Some brilliant video experience for you there. So these are factors that tend to produce benefits, whatever they are. And so we look at some of them. Better processes, controls, and documentation, mature processes, tangible improvements in process metrics, higher efficiency, staff reduction, decreasing IT expenses, increase in customer satisfaction. These just loop around to the bottom. So, like, staff reduction results in increase in organizational revenue. Similarly, decrease in IT expenses results in increase in organizational revenue. Now, the recommendation here is that the process should focus on the beginning points rather than the end points, which is actually pretty insightful. So many business process initiatives start with the objectives of, say, increasing organizational revenue, which leads them then to say, okay, well, the way to do that is decrease IT expenses and reduce staff, and they just do that. But they haven't thought of the impact on all of the other processes. Like, for example, and there should be an arrow here, if you reduce staff, you're probably going to have an impact on IT service quality improvements. If you decrease IT expenses, you may negatively impact your information system business environment. Etc. So, but the main point here is that there's no single starting point. If you start here, for example, better processes, control, and documentation, well, in order to get that, you need tangible improvements in process metrics. But in order to get that, you need mature processes. But in order to get that, you need better process control and documentation, etc. And we could draw more and more loops through this when describing our practices. So to come back here, right? So organizations should first focus on the benefits that promote, in other words, have arrows leading out, more than other benefits being promoted, in other words, with arrows leading in. And that seems pretty reasonable to me. Oops. There we go. So that's the IT framework side of things. And I have a slide later on that talks about the weaknesses of frameworks overall. But I want to preface that, or maybe anticipate that here, with a few remarks. And the first remark is, and I've suggested this already, none of these models is in any way democratic or anything remotely resembling democracy. We have this monarchy on one hand or anarchy on the other hand. And I think that's, well, it's maybe a caricature, but we could say that engineers view the world that way. Now, that's totally unfair to engineers, and I know that they are more multifaceted than that. But when you have governance processes that assume an organization is either a monarchy or an anarchy, there's a certain whole range of business processes that haven't been considered. But this really has to do with the nature of these frameworks themselves. So these frameworks aren't designed for society as a whole. And mostly we wouldn't govern a society that way, although Europe is maybe trying to show us differently. Therefore, the governance of specific companies and specific institutions that have clear lines of accountability and responsibility that are authority-driven, and even more to the point, that are mission and values-driven. And that's why these frameworks are all based around mission and values. And these missions and values sometimes include ethical components, but very often do not, and sometimes explicitly do not, particularly if the institution in question is a for-profit corporation, which has, you know, basically a responsibility to promote its own interests first. And you might consider, okay, promotion of ethics is sort of like enlightened self-interest, kind of, you know, a version of egoism. But it's not clear that egoism is a good basis on which to organize companies or to organize a society consisting of companies. And that's the friendly analysis. And I've heard it said, not completely inaccurately, by people like Harold Jarkey, among others, that corporations are literally psychotic in that they have no real concern for anything that isn't them. And to a certain degree, the same is true of institutions like colleges and universities, who very often, when they adopt these frameworks, do not look at the wider implications. Some of these frameworks do take into account stakeholders, but it's interesting to draw the distinction between stakeholders and people, right? A stakeholder is someone with a direct interest in the product or service being discussed. So a stakeholder is sort of almost like a shareholder of a company, but their interest isn't based on owning shares of the company. Their interest is in buying services or selling services to the company. It's still going to be a financial and perhaps commoditized kind of interest, as opposed to an ethical or a social or a cultural interest in a company. Like, I am interested in what Disney does, not because I'm a stakeholder. I don't even buy their movies. But because of the wider impact that they have on society. And I've said over the years various things about Disney and how I think the content produced by Disney is in various ways harmful to society. Different argument. Nonetheless, A framework that includes stakeholders does not include me when we're talking about Disney. A framework which includes society does include me, but these frameworks are based on, for the most part, stakeholders and not society. Although, with some of them, and particularly those focused on ethics, they do look at impacts on wider society. But it's not clear how these impacts come back to influence how the corporate or institutional governance operates. So, one of these wider frameworks is human rights. And so there has been, I'd say, a fair amount of discussion about the role of human rights frameworks in designing or implementing ethical frameworks. So, what is, first of all, a human rights framework? And what does it look like for algorithms? Well, here, from the rankingdigitalrights.org paper, we have, and I quote, "A human rights framework for algorithms that would, quote, not just set forth standards on how to do no harm or be ethical, but it would help hold companies accountable for those standards by providing mechanisms for risk assessment, enforcement, redress when harm has occurred, and individual empowerment for technology users." A bunch of stuff is happening there, right? Again, it's kind of an effort to drag us back up the staircase, because it's talking about holding companies ethical, providing mechanisms for risk assessment, providing redress, etc. But there's a little bit of down the staircase influence as well when we talk about individual empowerment for technology users. So while a human rights framework is kind of consequentialist in its intent, you know, seeking to root out and prevent violations of human rights, there's still something else, maybe not quite social contracty, but maybe sort of deontologic. Deontologically focused in individual empowerment. With respect to human rights, companies are not doing well, as this diagram indicates. You know, companies like Apple and Amazon and Verizon, Samsung, just don't give us any disclosure about how, say, users' online content is curated, ranked, or recommended. We get a little bit from Microsoft and Facebook, but again, nothing near adequate disclosure. And without disclosure, how can you tell whether they're violating human rights? So that suggests the needs for something like a human rights impact assessment. And this is one of these processes again. And so we're almost like back into the land of checklists. Joy. So we have planning and scoping. We have data collecting and baseline development. Stakeholder engagement throughout the process. That's nice. Analyzing impacts. Impact mitigation and management. Reporting and evaluation back to planning and scoping. You see how this is a very basic framework? It doesn't actually say what the human rights are, and what they are going to be is going to be defined by stakeholders, but remember, stakeholders are going to be only those directly affected. So, like, for example, I am not a stakeholder in the plight of the Rohingya. The Rohingya are an ethnic group in Southeast Asia that have been basically exiled from their homeland, along with a whole lot of, what's the phrase that they use, ethnic cleansing, and are unwelcome and unsafe in their new landing spot in Bangladesh, on islands that are just a few feet above sea level and sometimes a few feet below sea level. I'm not a stakeholder. So how do I get involved in this human rights impact assessment? Well, I don't. Unless I work for one of these companies. So you see sort of a weakness of this framework, and it's a similar sort of weakness that we saw with the IT governance framework, where, again, it's very institutionally focused. Again, it's based on interest rather than society, culture, or ethics. Again, it's process-based, but the process kind of reduces to a checklist. And again, we don't really have this core essence of what ethical is, although at least in principle, the idea that it's human rights means something like, if it promotes human rights, it's ethical. If it does not promote or opposes human rights, it's not ethical. But we talked about this already. We talked about this when we were talking about social contracts and how a human rights-based approach to ethics is going to be insufficient because a lot of the scope of ethics goes beyond human rights. But that's less of a criticism in this case because it's just one of many governance frameworks that we could be considering, and there may be other governance frameworks for other aspects of ethics that are not engaged or do not have anything to do with human rights. Here's an application of it. Thinking of human rights, designing for human rights. Now, it's interesting, Halbertal gives us three categories of human rights violations. Humiliation, that is being put in a state of helplessness, insignificance, losing autonomy over your own representation. To me, that's an odd way of putting it, but you can see how it's based on perhaps a deontological point of view of the individual. The second violation, instrumentalization, treating an individual as exchangeable and merely as a means to an end, and that very clearly is a deontological approach. And then third, rejection of one's gift, making an individual superfluous, unacknowledging one's contribution, aspiration, and potential. And again, I think that's a deontological perspective. So this particular application of a human rights framework is based on, I would say, a deontological representation of human rights. And that kind of is reflected in the sort of right here. The process is to begin with values, then expand to norms, which then talks about how to actually design for these things. So one of the values, and not surprisingly, is privacy. Which leads to informed consent to processing, confidentiality, and right to erasure, and people will recognize these as elements of Europe's GDPR. And then designing for these things, which is what's new in this kind of approach, is positive opt-in, homomorphic encryption, and data removal from live and backup storage. Okay, so The homomorphic encryption is kind of a fun one, and I'm not going to try defining that because I don't know what it means necessarily, although we could look it up on Google and we would probably know. Well, let's look it up on Google and then we'll know. So what are we going to do? And just as an aside, if we have to look up something on Google, it's probably not a basic human right. But okay, so homomorphic encryption. So, homomorphic encryption is a form of encryption that permits users to perform computations on its encrypted data without first decrypting it. Okay, so in the world of encryption and distributed ledger technologies, these are known as zero-knowledge proofs or zero-knowledge computations. And it's really quite interesting. And it's based on a principle something like this. Suppose you have a piece of data and you add a number to it and you have a new piece of data. Well, if you encrypt this piece of data, now you have the encrypted piece of data. Oh, we're not, I'm not seeing my hands here. Okay, so right screen. So, okay, you have this piece of data, right? And you do a calculation, you have a new piece of data. Now, if you encrypt this piece of data, there it is, and you perform the calculation on that, then there's a mathematical relation between the effect of the calculation on the encrypted piece of data and the effect of the calculation on the unencrypted data, such that you can test or perform the calculation on encrypted data and get the results that you wanted in unencrypted data. This means that you can use your own real data, encrypt it, send it to a third party, have that third party do stuff with your data, send back the results, also encrypted, you decrypt it, and now have your results or can verify your result. Zero knowledge proofs. Or if you want to get really fancy, look up ZK Snarks. Lots of fun. Okay, so aren't we glad we did that? So this is what happens though with terminology, right? Different people use different terminology to refer to the same sort of thing. All right, so back to human rights frameworks. Let's get back up here. There we go. So, again, human rights typically is taken from a deontological perspective on ethics. And it has an overlap with a social contract picture of ethics. And the idea expressed as fairness is something like, if we were signing a contract counterfactually, then we would probably sign a contract that respected various human rights. Why? Well, to give us equal opportunity, etc., etc. Justice is fairness and all of that. But we know that there's much more to ethics than justice is fairness. And so a human rights, designing for human rights, is going to partially, but by no means completely, address the ethical issues. Still, you see the application here, right? It's the use of a framework. The framework is run through a process. The process takes elements of that framework and produces concrete, tangible outcomes. And these outcomes, things like positive opt-in, homomorphic encryption, data removal from live and backup storage, generally tend to be elements of this workflow as informed by ethical considerations. So there's a lot to be said for the approach. So how does this work on a more broad-based or broad-based basis? Well, basically, what we're doing here is, in the field of ethics for analytics and AI, we're drawing on international human rights law. And what we're doing here is drawing on it, shall we say, as a means for assessing harm. Again, there are other harms, but we'll leave that aside. That gives us clearly defined obligation and expectations that apply across the algorithmic life cycle. Here I'm quoting from this report from Cambridge International Comparative Law Quarterly on international human rights law as a framework for algorithmic accountability. So there's the framework in the diagram. We can see it. Prevention, monitoring, and oversight, effective remedies. These are all elements that by now have become familiar to us, and they're playing a role in each step. And now this is a basic workflow, right? Conceptualization and analysis, design, testing, deployment, monitoring, and evaluation. Basic workflow, we know that our AI and analytics workflow is more complex, but we'll just plug in the AI and analytics workflow in here and then let it be informed by this international human rights law framework. So what's that going to do for us? It's going to identify the roles and responsibilities across the full algorithmic life cycle, or the full algorithmic workflow. Life cycle and workflow are going to basically mean the same thing here. Operationalize, that is, describe in operational terms the measures necessary to ensure rights compliance. And then third, integrating a rigorous accountability framework. By rigorous, what we mean is not strict or really hard to comply with or anything like that. What it means is an accountability framework that has actual numbers and principles attached to it. So it's not based on someone's perception that, yes, I think we were ethical here, or our ethical compliance was high. It'll be focused on specific indicators and specific ranges of values for those indicators that allows for what we could call an objective assessment of rights compliance in this case. Again, not unreasonable, not wrong. Okay. So what are the limitations of this approach? There's a good discussion by Natalie Schmuha from 2020 looking at what we need beyond a human rights-based approach to AI governance. A very good paper, definitely recommended. So she considers four objections. She's going to argue against these as objections, but I think that we could maybe still make a pretty strong case for them. Nonetheless, here are the objections that she's going to dismiss. First of all, that these rights may be too Western, that an Eastern or Southern analysis of human rights might be different. Point, I think, is reasonable. She's going to argue that, or some people argue that human rights frameworks are too individualist, they're too focused on individual rights. But I think there's a widespread acknowledgement and acceptance that there are such things as cultural rights or community rights that can also be violated in the context of human rights. Like, for example, genocide isn't a thing that you do to a person. It's a thing that you do to a culture. It involves people, obviously, but it's the culture that's being wiped out. I think that human rights frameworks are too narrow in scope, although it is arguable that everything that's ethical could be covered under human rights frameworks. I don't agree, because I don't think all questions of ethics are questions of human rights. But, there's room for debate there. And then the last is that the use of human rights frameworks is too abstract to form the basis of sound AI governance. But I think we've seen that this isn't the case. We can work from, as we saw before, from values through to norms through to specific design requirements. And that's not abstract. If it gets right to the point of design requirements, now you're well into the software development process and you've got concrete stuff you can work with. Rather, she says that human rights frameworks in some important ways require democracy. And she writes, without securing an underlying societal infrastructure that enables human rights in the first place, any human rights-based governance framework for AI risks falling short of its purpose. And we could probably broaden that and say ethical instead of human rights, and the same point could be made. Without an underlying societal infrastructure that enables an ethical stance in the first place. Any ethics-based framework, governance framework for AI, risks falling short of its purpose. The society needs to support the framework. It's just like I said before, right? We all agree that aircraft should be safe. There's nobody out there arguing for unsafe aircraft. We all agree that surgeons should not leave their gloves inside patients. Nobody is out there on the pro-glove side. But with ethics, we're not in that situation. At least not obviously. With ethics, with a lot of the ethical principles that have been discussed, even in these videos, autonomy, consent, etc., there isn't a clear societal infrastructure that enables these. And that's the problem. And so there isn't this overlapping of ethics and democracy that we need to take place. I mentioned earlier that community can be defined by consensus, where a community is identified by the way it defines a source of truth. That perhaps is the first failing in our current communities, where we don't have structural mechanisms that allow us to come to an understanding of what will constitute a single source of truth in our society. Now, would a common shared ethics follow from that? Well, no, probably not. But at least we would have the grounds on which to have that kind of conversation so that we could design systems and methods that allow for differences in ethical perspectives, but still allow us to work together in order to create software that respects those. But if we're in a situation where one side is right and the other side is wrong, period, end of story, you don't have the grounds for those kind of discussions. And right now, that's what we lack. And that's why these frameworks, the data management framework, the AI framework, the human rights frameworks, they're nice, they're useful, they're great for addressing risks. They're less stringent than regulation and therefore more widely applicable, and can take into account exceptions and special circumstances, context-specific applications, or as they call them, application profiles, etc. But they don't have this surround that they need that would lead people to use them. And that's the problem. And this is an issue with governance frameworks generally. They are designed not for wider society, where you do have these dramatic differences, where you do have a more democratic governance structure, and that's pretty much true almost all around the world, where individuals who are not necessarily stakeholders do have a point of view. Governance frameworks are designed for organizations with a single point of view, single set of values, single perspective, single mandate. Governance frameworks depend on agreement and shared presumptions, on things like vocabulary, on what's right, what's wrong, what's valuable, what's not valuable, what counts as a benefit, what doesn't. And in the end, they're not actually based on ethics. They are governance frameworks. They tell us how to manage things, what all the processes are, what they should be. And in that, they're incredibly useful. But they don't tell us why we're doing this management. And they put culture, ethics, and behaviors in a little box that's overwhelmed by all the rest of the stuff. And finally, the problem with governance frameworks is humans. A human will follow a governance framework for as long as it's convenient to do so. Convenience may be the wrong word, but as long as it's acceptable to do so or profitable to do so, pick your word, right? But at a certain point, they won't. And this is where we have a clash between ethics and governance frameworks. You can identify sometimes very precisely what the person has done that's unethical, or at least goes against the governance process, but not why they shouldn't have done it. Simply that it didn't follow the process isn't enough of an ethical motivator for people. I hear all the time people saying, you know, we really need to focus on the process and not the results. The process is what matters. That's fine until you're harmed by the results. Or that's fine until the results reduce you from the status of being a person to being a non-person, as happened to the Rohingya. And then you can't trust the process anymore. And finally, it is arguable, this is the point of things like critical race theory and critical theory in general, the process is rigged. Now, this is a much bigger discussion. It's one that Chomsky attempted in Manufacturing Consent, and we saw how well that was accepted by the keepers of the process. But and it's also covered by people like Naomi Klein. The process does favor authority. There is no democratic mechanism in the process. It does favor some particular kind of order within it. You know, it's an ontological, rules-based sort of order. And it views things that aren't consistent with the process as being something like anarchy, which I don't think is the case at all. And, you know, it rewards the powerful and kind of shrugs its shoulders when people are harmed by the process. Now, perhaps these are all unfair criticisms. And, you know, not all processes in all of the world, not all systems, not all organizations or institutions favor the wealthy, harm the poor, etc. But there is a preponderance of this. And there's nothing inside the mechanism of governance frameworks that even suggests that there's a problem with that. And to me, that tells me that a governance framework, like a regulation, could be used as a mechanism for implementing something, but not as a mechanism for deciding what to implement. All right. One more video in this series, and then we're done with ethical practices, and we'll move on to the next part of the module. So that's it for this one. I'm Stephen Downs. See you in part 5.